if you believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. What do you believe? Your safety is your responsibility, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much, RJ Hinder. All right, guys, RBN is having a pledge drive. If you haven't heard already, you're going to hear again. Anyone who would like to donate, please call 800-724-2719. Obviously, a toll-free call. That's during office hours, 10 to 6 Central Time, Monday through Friday. Otherwise, if you'd like to donate, you can also go online to republicbroadcasting.org, because we are an org. We are an organization. Republicbroadcasting.org. You can donate to the RBN pledge drive there. All right. A lot of stuff to get to, actually. There's been a number of things going on. There was actually a police-involved shooting of sorts in Pahrump, my little town, yesterday morning. I was not here yesterday. You might be able to hear I am not really feeling that great. In the mornings, I wake up, I really got a bit of a head cold, and it stinks. And it takes a couple of hours to really start getting normal. And so I just yesterday just kicked my butt, and I woke up with a really bad headache. So we replayed a show from earlier in the month. I am here today. I'm still not feeling that great, but I'm better than I was yesterday. Yesterday, with this police-involved shooting, let me explain to you what happened. Up on just a standard road, up at it's a business park is what it is. One of the lessees, pardon me, I had to hit the cough button. One of the lessees at this business park is the highway patrol office, as well as the parole and the parole agents, the parole and probation officers that work out of the same office. Well, evidently yesterday, a parolee went in to meet with his PO. And I'm guessing, only guessing, I'm theorizing, that the PO told the parolee that he was headed back to jail, back to prison. And whatever it was, that parolee decided to run outside and get into his car, which was backed in front of a real estate office. And the PO runs out there in front of the car, which is, you know, pretty much stupid. And the guy starts up the car, hits the gas. The PO pulls out his gun and launches four rounds at the car, completely missing it and hitting the occupied building behind it. The parolee, who's escaping, takes a sharp turn, misses the PO. We don't even know if he's actually trying to run the PO down or if the PO was just swinging his large intestinal fortitude, trying to be some movie cop and shooting at a car. And then the PO ended up, you know, taking off down the street. So the parolee took off down the street. The PO holsters his gun, walks back into the office, and goes in there to, I guess, start reporting this whole thing. So when we come back from this break coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the information that has come to light about this. And Bill's view of shooting at a moving vehicle and an historical account of such behavior and activities. So stay tuned. You're going to want to hear this. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is live. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, guys, welcome back. So this shooting involving a state parole officer yesterday. Now he ends up, a parolee gets into his car, starts it up, and takes off. So he starts shooting at the occupied vehicle. There has never been a case that I have ever come across that has a single shooter, a single cop, firing at a moving vehicle, and that moving vehicle stopping, without causing serious injury or serious property damage in the process. And the only time that has happened is when they shot at the car and the driver ends up, you know, leaning down and swerving and crashing into somebody on a sidewalk, somebody else's car, or into a utility pole, and that comes crashing down, something along that lines. You know who the person is in this case. He knows who the person is. They're in the car. You don't go stand in front of a moving car. Here's the thing. You're firing a gun. In this case, the guy's probably got a 9mm. He's probably got 115 grains of stopping power behind each bullet. If you measured the weight of the car in grains, it's probably about 16 billion grains. 115 against somewhere around 16 billion. That is not a good fight. For handgun rounds especially, to penetrate through a windshield, through glass, and actually penetrate and hit the driver is few and far between. You just don't see that, even if you pound several rounds through it. That is exactly what I'm talking about. You cannot get it done. So what does this jackass of a parole officer do? He goes out there and fires it, gets in front of the car and says, "Stop! I'm a cop!" Right? It doesn't work. So once it's all done, he goes back into the office, gathers up his other fellow parole and probation officers, and what do? They grab their tasers and go around to all of the offices in the area with tasers at the ready, asking if everyone's okay. Explain to me why you would do that. There was one guy involved. He got into the car. He took off. He went down the street away from the building you were at. So you come out with your buddies, tasers at the ready to make sure everyone's okay. Because maybe if you really truly are okay, they're going to tase you to make sure you're not. I don't get it. I don't understand why they would ever go around with tasers at the ready, ready to just snap it up and shoot somebody with it, while evidently being concerned for the safety of the people in the office. Doesn't add up. Okay. And that sort of thing just really drives me nuts. And it's perfect timing to bring up a story, a joke, that was emailed to me right now along this same line. Called "The Power of the Badge." A DEA officer stops at a ranch in South Dakota and talks with an old rancher. He tells the rancher, "I need to inspect your ranch for illegally grown drugs." The rancher says, "Okay, but don't go into that field over there." And he points out the location. The DEA officer verbally explodes, saying, "Mister, I have the authority of the federal government with me." Reaching into his rear pocket, he removes his badge and proudly displays it to the rancher. "See this badge? This badge means I'm allowed to go wherever I wish, on any line, no questions asked, no answers given. Have I made myself clear? Do you understand?" The rancher nods politely, apologizes, and then goes about his chores. A short time later, the old rancher hears loud screams and sees the DEA officer running for his life, being chased by the rancher's bull coming from the field he warned the DEA agent about. With every step, the bull is gaining ground on the officer, and it seems likely that he's about to get gorged before he reaches safety. The officer is clearly terrified, so the rancher throws down his tools, runs to the fence, and yells at the top of his lungs, "Your badge! Show him your badge!" Because the badge is so wonderfully, it'll explain everything away. It's so powerful. Seems as though that the cop in front of the car yesterday, the parole officer in front of the car, was looking for something along that lines. Now I got to tell you, I have met several parole and probation officers in the past, and what they tend to do is you know, they're watching these felons. Some of them are even formerly violent felons, and they're allowed to do, you know, home searches and things. So they get all jocked up into this tactical gear, and they go and they start tossing houses because they're the man. They're long arm of the law. They're the man. Y'all going to do what we tell you to do, and if not, we'll pull out our guns. We're going to shoot you because we're a tactical parole and probation officer team. Ha, ha. And that's really kind of the attitude. I had a guy working for me that was on probation, and he and some buddies played a joke on a chick that they knew that was a bartender and boosted her car and drove her down the street a couple of blocks and parked it. Well, she didn't think that was funny, so she involved the cops. One of these things where she could dish it out, but she couldn't take it. Okay. Well, my employee's parole officer was one of these guys that would walk around in tactical gear. He was wearing, you know, cargo pants and 5'11s, had his thigh rig on him, you know, all the black matte finished web nylon gear, and, you know, the polo that was stretched a little too tight, and always kept his tactical vest proudly displayed over the back of his car like a jacket would lean over the back of a chair. So this is the kind of guy he was. So I invited him actually to take a class sometime. He said, you know what, there's nothing out there that they could teach me that I don't already know. So what does that tell you? Pardon me, cough button. That tells you that somebody's just plain ignorant. And I said, well, you might be surprised. The class is free. I'm happy to put you through it. All you have to do is cough up a little ammo, and if that's even rough, I'll see what I can do about helping you out with that, because you are a you know, parole and probation officer. Yeah, wouldn't have anything to do with it, so whatever. All right, a few things that are going on. I stopped talking a couple weeks ago about the 2A radio 3D handgun course coming up in March. There's a good reason for that, and now I'm going to tell you. I am a semi-finalist in the casting of a kind of a competition shooting television program that's going to be coming up. There were many, many people that put in for this show. I cannot talk about the show. I cannot talk about the network that it's on. It is a national network. It is not an ABC, NBC, CBS. But it is a big network. If I told you, everybody would have heard of this. Everybody has seen programs on this. They're putting a show together with shooters who come from various backgrounds, and they're putting together several different competitions, and it's like an elimination sort of process. I have made it to the semi-finalist of the casting. So there's under 100 of us going for, I think, under 20 spots. And that is happening. I actually go do that sometime middle of February. And if cast in the final casting, then the shooting of the show, the filming of the show, actually takes place part of March into April, which would run right over the middle of the handgun course. So I am pushing the handgun course back to somewhere around the April 27th mark, probably the last or third or fourth weekend in April is what I'm looking for now. I am going to, whether I make it into this show or I don't make it into this show, I want to have a solid date that either way we can all plan on. So I am going to confirm the dates, like the longest it would stretch out, say if I were to make it, you know, very, very far. First, if I get cast. Second, if I could make it very, very far into this deal, how long I'm going to be away. Now, if that happens, I will still be doing my radio show one way or another, hell or high water. I will still be doing my radio show. Even if I have to record it at night and play it in the morning, one way or another, I'm not just going to leave the air, because it could take 5 to 6 weeks to actually film this entire thing. I don't know how long they anticipate having everyone gone. If it's you're gone for 5 or 6 weeks filming this thing and then you finally go home, or if they have a couple of breaks here and there. And I imagine there'd probably be some breaks. I doubt they're going to run the crew every single day of the week. But you never know. Sometimes they do that. So, with that having been said, I cannot really say anything else about it. I have turned in all of my paperwork, all of the forms, all of the stuff that they need. The casting is middle of February. That's the final call. It's 3 days in L.A., and we'll see how it goes. So, just wanted to give you a heads up on that. A couple of other things about this this shooting in Pahrump. Evidently, when... let me actually pull up the story here real quick. When the Nye County Sheriff's Office came to do this investigation, somebody in an unmarked unit, believed to be an assistant sheriff, drove right through the evidence scene, including where the shell casings and such were. So just I wanted to add that in as a little bit of knuckleheadedness on our local sheriff's department, evidently pulling right up to the front of a scene, which is something, as a cop, you just don't do. And if you're an assistant sheriff doing that, something tells me that maybe you shouldn't have that job. Doesn't just sound right. Anyway, guys, we got plenty more to come. We're done with that whole shooting in Pahrump, and we're going to carry on some other things. Stay tuned. We'll get to them after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
All right, guys, a couple of things. This comes from a lady named Robbie in Lompoc, California, listener. She says, Bill, I want your opinion on a security issue because everyone I work with thinks I'm nuts, and I think they're nuts. So right off the bat, when I read that, it just pops into my head. This sounds like somebody who is in California and is a conservative living in condition yellow, and all the coworkers there in sunny California have their heads so far up their kazoo they're living in combination between condition white or condition brown. As it turns out, I was right. Listen to the rest. I have to go to work in El Paso, Texas. I have to stay there for 2 nights. She says, I'm freaked out, like Code Orange. Pardon me. Because I couldn't think of a more dangerous place to have to go. Especially as I'm about as American as they come. Blonde hair, blue-eyed female. I know Juarez, which is actually Juarez, over the border, has basically been taken over by the cartels for human trafficking and other unsavory acts. But of course, no media coverage makes it over here to California, where my liberal co-workers are wafting through life in code white. So, who gets the award for nut job? Also, are you still considering doing a class with Shailene Nightingale over here in California, California gubernatorial candidate? I know her and lots of her friends, and I'd love to attend. Robbie, Lompoc, California. All right, Robbie. I sent Robbie an email response. I'm going to tell you my whole thoughts on this. First of all, El Paso, Texas is not nearly as dangerous as places like Washington, D.C., Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Detroit, because in El Paso, Texas, they don't mind you carrying around guns. Quite honestly, the Texans in El Paso, who are quite well-armed, tend to be a bit of a... distraction for the otherwise would-be traffickers and scumbags streaming across from Mexico. So it's not that bad. I was in El Paso this last April. Really, there's not that much to worry about. Obviously, keep your head on a swivel. It's going to be a town you probably haven't been to, one you're probably not familiar with. And if you feel like you carry a gun, I mean, you're in Texas. You can carry a gun in Texas. Texas rocks. I love Texas. Someday, if I don't end up living in someplace tropical like Hawaii, I might end up in Texas. I like the attitude of the state all the way around. So when it comes to being nuts, first of all, you're in California. So if you're thinking about condition yellow, the color code of mental awareness and the conditions that they come in. If you're conservative by nature, you like people like Shalene Nightingale. Obviously, in that realm, you would be the nut job because you're actually in the insane asylum and you don't fit in California. The few people who would otherwise be considered sane in California, the few hundred that are there, maybe there's 1,000, I don't know. You actually are looked at as the outcast because everyone else is off the deep end. So officially, they're the nut jobs. However, within that realm, you're the only one who's in Rome not doing as the Romans do, so that's why you're looked at as the nut job. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, Robbie. I wish you a lot of luck, and let me know how the trip goes. Be interesting to find out what you happen to see and experience in El Paso. They have some great restaurants there, by the way. I just have to say, there are some great restaurants in El Paso. I have another question from a buddy of mine by the name of Eric. And Eric and I are going to do a little bit of shotgun training coming up in another week or so. And I told him, go ahead and get some slugs. And he says, I'm looking at all different kinds of slugs. Brennecke and Federal have some cool-looking Sable hollow point ammo. Are these worth the price, or is a slug a slug? All right, 1 second. Sorry, cough button. Okay, when it comes, now this is Eric. I've read a couple of emails from him before. He's had he had a Remington 870 that he's getting in exchange for a Mossberg 590 that he got. He got in a 590, decided that things weren't quite all that great with it, so he traded it and upgraded, in my opinion, to a Remington 870. So here's the thing. With all shotguns, especially these defensive shotguns, I shouldn't say especially, including these defensive shotguns, you need to pattern the guns. There's only two things you're ever going to want to fire out of a defensive shotgun: double-odd buck or a slug. You can use birdshot, but only for training, not for home defense. You need to buy several different boxes of slugs and several different boxes of buckshot. You want to pattern the buckshot and see what your gun likes. Somebody else might have the identical gun, but the shot is going to pattern differently from their gun to your gun. Same thing with the slugs. Buy plenty of different slugs and see which ones are more accurate. Sandbag rest these things. Go out to about 75 yards, 50 to 75 yards, shooting at paper, and see which ones give you the better groups. You're talking about a rifled slug, a rifled sabot slug, and an unrifled barrel. That's what you want. You don't want a smooth-edged slug in a smooth-bored shotgun. You can get these slugs that actually have a bit of rifling in them. That's what you want to try. So that's how I want everybody to pattern their defensive shotguns. Stay tuned, guys. There's plenty more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
By dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
I get another email from a fellow named Tom in Winnipeg, Canada. He says, good day to you, Bill. Great show and thanks. I recently bought a new Savage 111 FC. After boar sighting with my eye on a tree branch, I went off to hunt. Shot 4 deer over 24 hours at ranges from 25 to 165 yards. Filled all 4 tags for the area. Was a pleasure to shoot. The recoil pad built into the buttstock works perfectly. The drop of about 3 round, let's see. The drop out 3 round mag falls perfectly when the actuators pushed. Hell of a bang. Wow. Obviously, I made my opinion clear. I'd like to know yours. Thanks, Tom P. Winnipeg, Canada. First of all, A, Tom. Okay, that was cheesy. The Savage rifles, I'm a big fan of. Have been for a few years. Several years ago, I wanted to build myself a new precision rifle, new sniper rifle. And I wanted to accomplish a couple of things just to see if I could. And that was, I wanted to build a proper, deployable, usable, not just temporary, but long-term usable, precision rifle. And spend as little money as possible to get guaranteed accuracy. And I did it. I shouldn't say I actually spent, but the value of the gun, the rings, the base, the scope, the bipod, the gear that I actually, the actual necessity gear, was right around $1,300. That was it. That's all I needed to spend. I got a Savage 10 FP LE2, which is a 26-inch barreled 308 with a 1 in 10 twist. On top of that, and that gun was right around $400, $425. On top of it, I put a 20 MOA one-piece Ken Farrell base. I then used Badger Ordnance rings, and then on top of that, put what's essentially a Mark IV scope. It's a loophole VX3 long-range tactical illuminated mil dot reticle, 3.5 to 10 power. Which is essentially what the Mark IV is now. A year or two later, it went to being called the Mark IV, the same scope. And I got that gun brand new. I found it on GunBroker, got a good deal on it. So I got it shipped to me and you know, paid the transfer, whatever BS, $25 background check. Then I got a Harris S bipod on it, a swiveling short bipod, and I got a good deal out of that off of Brownells. I got the base from Ken Farrell themselves. Ken Farrell makes bases for the guys who actually operate and the owner also of Savage. So of all the different goofy type of actions that, I shouldn't say goofy, there's several different actions. The action on my gun in particular was only made for less than a year. So to find a base for that was kind of difficult. However, it was a newer gun at the time and Ken Farrell obviously knows those making, so he has a base for it. And then I got the scope from samplelist.com. If you're looking for any sort of glass, be it binoculars, monoculars, scopes, spotting scopes, whether it's a hunting scope, a reflex, an ACOG, whatever, Sample List is part of SWFA.com. Sample List is where these optics that are listed on there were used as samples, oftentimes at a trade show, mounted onto a gun or something like that. They don't have any real use to it. They might have ring marks on them, but they're essentially new scopes that were mounted onto guns or displayed. And you can get screaming deals on these things. I would imagine that right now or within the next week, they're going to be absolutely flooded with stuff that were displayed at the SHOT Show. That's my imagination. That's historical, actually. So samplelist.com is a place to go look for different optics. It's a great source. So I got my scope off of that. I got a good deal on some Badger Ordnance rings. I had maybe $1,300 invested in this whole package, where oftentimes people will put $4,000 into their package, which is, you know, unnecessary. So anyhow, I built that thing out. Great gun. So when it comes to the Savage 111 FC, Tom, I got to tell you, you got a great gun. And that it has an actual removable 3-round magazine is fantastic. The only thing you didn't tell us was what caliber that gun is. You never told me what the caliber was. So shoot me another email. Let me know what the caliber was. It'd be interesting. I'm guessing if you're up there and you said hell of a bang, you might be shooting a 7mm Remington Magnum, maybe a 30-06. You know, I don't know. I don't know what you're shooting out of that gun. But, you know, let me know. It'd be interesting. I have been working on a subsonic 308 load for my Savage rifle I was just describing. And I've been a little miffed that online you can't really find any sort of load data for the 308 in a subsonic load. Even went by the Lapua booth at the SHOT Show, because they sell a subsonic load, and said, you know, you guys don't publish. This is the only round you guys don't publish the load data on. Oh, yeah, that's right, because, you know, it depends on barrel length, twist rate, things like that. So, you know, it's we can't really do it because one load for this gun is going to work for that gun. Well, as it turns out, I was doing more and more research, and they're right. And the reason I was doing more and more research is yesterday I finally got down, at least, I wouldn't say perfected, but I have a load that I used. After I started feeling a little bit better, I went out, I had 15 rounds. I had five each of three different loads. Really what they were is it was just bullet configuration. And I had the Lapua subsonic bullets. I had five of those. I had five more of the Lapua subsonics that I'd actually lubed. And then I had five of the Sierra 200 grain, they're kind of like a Game King of sorts, and I had lubed those as well. And I went out to sight these things in. First thing I did was I just loaded up my gun with standard rounds, fired into the black square at 100 yards where the gun sighted in, and they all fired just fine, still holding sub-minute angles. Then I did the same thing, but I threaded my suppressor onto the gun to see where it would hit. And it's hitting 2 minutes low, 2 inches low at 100 yards, 2 minutes of angle low. So I know that. If I'm going to thread my can on there, I need to adjust 2 minutes up to make sure that those rounds are going to impact center. Then I fired each five rounds each of those three loads I previously described. The Sierras, pardon me, the Lube Sierra bullets flew pretty well, grouped pretty well, and they actually hit, all of these rounds hit about 18 inches low of my standard sight-in, which ends up working out not bad at all, because I have a mil dot reticle. And so I have a tiny little crosshair in the center, and then I have these dots going off to each side and then going up and going down. And these dots go out just so far before you end up with a heavy black line and a kind of a crosshair style reticle that goes from just below the dots down to the bottom of the scope, up to the top of the scope, and out to each side of the scope. So what I realized was at 100 yards, and these subsonic rounds are not really good for more than about 125 yards. At 100 yards, all I have to do is put that bottom line, the bottom heavy line below the lowest mil dot, right on where I want it to hit on the target, and it's lined up. It just works out that way. It worked out nicely, so I don't have to go adjusting for 18 minutes of angle if I need to shoot this. It's just a different hold, and I know right where the hold is. The Sierras flew rather well. The lubed Lapuas flew the best grouping. I had just slightly over an inch pattern with the lube Lapuas. With the Lapuas that were not lubed, the dry ones, I actually got the worst performance, and everything else was the same. And I will describe for you what I did, and then I'll describe for you some of the things to look for, some of the things to be aware of. Again, I'm running a 26-inch barrel with a 1 in 10 twist. If you have anything different than that, your load's going to be quite a bit different. What I have is I have casings, and I have full-length sized them. They are not fire-formed. Full-length sized per several different online sources that I read. Pardon me. You can oftentimes get better accuracy out of loads if the casing has already been fired in the chamber of that gun. It's been you know, fire-formed. And if you seat the bullet so far out, it's touching or nearly touching the rifling. Not so in subsonic rounds. Have a full-length case, and then you want to seat the bullet back in a little bit further. Now, the only thing I'm going to play with now is seating depth, because everything else is working out fine. I took the casings, and I drilled a 9/64-inch hole where the flash hole is. I increased the size of the flash hole to about 3 to 4 times the volume by drilling it out to 9/64. I then also used a large rifle magnum primer in these 308 casings. Not a standard primer, but a magnum primer. I then loaded in there a powder, which is, it takes up a fair amount of room for what it is. And that is red dot, which is commonly used for shotguns. One of the fastest burning powder, I think it's the second or third fastest burning powder of all the powders available. So it is a magnum primer with a lot of flash, going through an enlarged flash hole, hitting very fast burning powder. It's really the secret to these subsonic loads, from what I have learned. So I was using just under 9 grains of the red dot. I used 8.9 grains of red dot. And then I seated the bullet, and stand for a 200 grain bullet, you can go to 2.8 inches overall length. I went to 2.75 inches. So I was 0.05 under what I could have done. Certainly even further than that if I were trying to get to the rifling. So I'm going to try to extend that out a little bit. I might go to 2.8. I might try some 2.85s. I probably will and see where I go. Then when I lubed the bullets, what I do is I used actually Crisco oil. I did not use the pork lard because I couldn't find any without some of the sugars in it. I need to without the glycol or whatever the hell they put in that stuff. I need to find some without that. So I heated that up. I actually just put it in a cup, put it in the microwave till it became liquefied, turned the cup on edge, rolled the bullet in there, and then let it dry, and then wiped it off. Just wiped it off. So there was nothing more than a tiny, tiny, very, very thin film of anything on there. I did not want to have this gunky lard buildup in my chamber and going down the barrel. So I wiped all of that stuff off. It wasn't even actually completely cold. I while it was cooling, I let it sit for maybe 30 seconds. Then I wiped all that stuff off, got it all out of there. Then before I fired them, I wiped them again. I only wanted the tiniest little bit of lubricant on there. The reason is, copper is actually, which is what these things are jacketed. It's a copper jacketed lead bullet. The copper is actually kind of a sticky metal. It's not really that smooth. So for that softer, not quite so smooth, stickier metal, that jacketing, to be pressed into the rifling of a chrome-lined barrel, it wants to hold up and stop, especially since the barrel is actually squeezing it down to where the barrel is smaller than the actual outer diameter of the bullet. So to have that copper on there and shooting an otherwise well above supersonic load, subsonic, you're going to run into trouble. So you either need a coated bullet, like something moly-coated or Teflon-coated, or you go with, you actually have to lube the thing. So that was what I was recommended to do. So that's what I did. So I ended up averaging. I fired with the Lapuas that were lightly lubed. And, I fired those. I had a good group. I know exactly where they're going to land. I don't have to worry about readjusting. And, I ended up with just slightly over an inch. So again, I'm going to play a little bit with seating depth. I'm going to seat them out a little bit further, a couple of different distances, and then try those for accuracy. Whatever works out best is going to be my load. And, pardon me. Jeez, I need to get over this. I was very happy with the results. I ended up with a spread of these 5 rounds of 12 feet per second. The average was 975 feet per second, which is clearly subsonic. Subsonic ends up being right around 1,050. 950 was the lowest that I really wanted to accept. 975 as an average with 12 feet per second deviation between these 5 rounds, I'm happy with. So I am going to be just a tiny bit more accurate when it comes to actually weighing out the powder. And then I am also going to, again, play with the seating depth a little bit. And then I should have my subsonic load. A lot of people look for subsonic 223 loads, or 5.56 millimeter. Those are actually, there's quite a few of those out there. There's three or four different companies that make subsonic 308 loads. And be prepared to pay $2 to $2.50 per round for those things if you don't cook them up yourself. But then you also have to be prepared that they might not be set up for your gun. When loading something subsonic for what otherwise is not subsonic, you have to be very careful and pretty much brew up these rounds yourself based on the principles which I described, which are available online. When it comes to the .223 subsonic loads, those are out there. You can find those for just about any barrel length and twist rate from several different companies. So if you're looking for something like that, well, then that's good. The other cool thing about these .308 subsonic loads, they're still delivering around 450 foot-pounds of energy, which is heavy. So a 200-grain bullet, 450 foot-pounds of energy, that's very similar to a .45 ACP. So a good round, flies pretty well, impacts well, has plenty of energy behind it. Good round. I might actually try to dump a couple of coyotes with this round just to see how it goes. So, there you go. My story on subsonic loads. Stay tuned, guys. Got a little bit more to come in the final segment. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong, and this is not where you belong.
All right, guys. I got to tell you, I started working out again. I got a gym membership a few months ago, and I worked out one time with Dave Champion. I dropped the ball and just stopped. So anyhow, I'm a little bit sick and tired of not being in the cardiovascular shape that I am, not having the muscle mass that I used to. So I've been working out with Dave. As a matter of fact, I think four times in the last 5 days I've hit the gym same time he has. We're going again tonight. And it was after the very first night I get home, and I start feeling a little bit sick. And here's the deal. This has happened before. You know, you start working out, you start some of the toxins and build up in your body start, you know, coming out. And oftentimes you feel sick. And I really think that's what's going on because I've been working out at night. So, you know, many hours later, I'm just not feeling so hot. My plan is once I get some good, you know, good solid exercise, a good routine down, working out with Dave for a couple of weeks, I'm going to start going right after the show. As soon as I'm done with this radio show, I'm going to go in. Now, I'm not one to love the gym. We go to the gym. As a matter of fact, Dave and I were working out one day this last weekend, and I think it was Saturday. We spent 3.5 hours in the gym, which is about 3 hours longer than what I want to spend in the gym. But Dave loves it. He loves going to the gym. If he could spend 3-4 hours a day there, he would. Dave goes to the gym 5-6 days a week. And, you know, he does a little workout, you know, this area, that area, then gone. I'm not that way. I'm the type of guy, when I'm done, I am probably going to go to the gym once or twice a week, do circuit training, hit all kinds of stuff. Like, I might do all upper body stuff, circuit training one day. Then all legs and core, circuit training another day, maybe 2 or 3 days later. And that's it. I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time in the gym. I don't like doing cardio, so if I do circuit training, I can do weights and cardio all at the same time in the same set of exercises and get all of this done in about an hour, 2 different days a week. That's my goal. I don't like the gym. I don't enjoy the environment. I don't enjoy going there and getting sweaty and spending hours and hours of my day. I feel rather unproductive, although it's working for me. So anyhow, I think that might be what's going on with me feeling a little bit cold. We'll be there today, and then I'm actually not going to be back in there till probably Sunday. I'm going to be traveling for a couple of days, so I'm not going to be going to the gym. However, hopefully things will work out. I hope not to continue feeling like this. It kind of stinks. But anyhow, just as kind of a thought, let you know a couple of the things that I'm doing. Just to let you guys know, folks, you can always look up the website, 2aradio.com, and you can always check out the web, or send me an email, bill@2aradio.com.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Stay tuned for more great programming here on RBN. You've got, let's see, the Lenman News Hour coming up next, followed by the Ernest Hancock Show after that. Stay tuned, guys. Plenty of good radio coming at you.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.